This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa. JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief at FanDuel and at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 244 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. I ended up getting a lot of great questions this week, so we'll get to those right away on today's show. But before doing so, I wanted to send another reminder about FanDuel's MLB Home Run Challenge. Enter the free Home Run Challenge contest any day from May 1st to May 30th, where you select any three hitters to hit home runs. If your entry has the highest total amount of home runs on the night, you'll win a share of $1,000. And if that's not enough, each daily winner will earn one entry into the $20,000 Home Run Championship on May 31st. For more information, visit FanDuel.com or download the app today. Eligibility restrictions apply. Today's first mailbag question comes from Twitter. It's from @RobbieTJones. It says, is there any exception to the rule of taking a quarterback late? In a keeper league, I've got Diggs, Ingram, Kerryon, Aaron Jones, and five of the top 25 picks. Assuming four of those five are used on skill players, is it a fantasy football sin to get an elite quarterback with pick 25? So a few things here. First, remember that the late round quarterback strategy isn't simply about playing a game of chicken and being the last team to select a quarterback. It's about extracting value. And value generally comes in the form of waiting on your quarterback for a ton of reasons. Another thing to point out here, though, is that pick 25 is clearly not the typical pick 25. You have so many keepers in this league. Now, there's a keeper podcast that I did last year that talks about this in more detail, but depending on the number of keepers there are, that pick 25 could be the equivalent of like a 9th or a 10th round pick in a regular redraft league. So I can't answer the question in your case of whether or not you, in your particular draft, should take a quarterback there. What I can say is that just because the rest of your roster is loaded doesn't mean that I would take a quarterback earlier. Because quarterbacks bust at a higher rate than we realize they do, they're replaceable, and my own players are going to bust too. I can't assume that Kerryon Johnson and Aaron Jones will both be start-worthy options next year. So I want depth to not only overcome those potential busts, but to also trade and upgrade my starting lineup. Now you can get a quarterback if you want, but just make sure that you're not doing it out of luxury. Make sure you're still doing it to extract value. This next question is from @22JBright. Do you think what people consider a good or bad landing spot makes a good argument for or against a player, or looking at it from that point is overrated? That is to say, how often do people accurately predict a good landing spot? Yeah, so I've mentioned landing spot as something that matters on this podcast in the past, because I believe that it matters. I don't think all landing spots are predictable, though. Meaning there's no way we're going to be able to predict what the three-year team situation looks like for every single team across the league. That would be impossible. But there are some stable pieces that we can look at. And the most important one of those pieces is the quarterback position. If you look at pass defense, rush defense, pass offense, and rush offense year over year, the one that's most stable is pass offense. And the reason is because quarterbacks are driving that piece of the field, and quarterbacks are usually consistently good or consistently not good. Andrew Luck, Drew Brees, Tom Brady, Aaron Rodgers, Matt Ryan, Ben Roethlisberger, there are quarterbacks who you know will at least be pretty damn good the following season. Maybe they won't be as good as they were the previous year, but you at least know that you're getting better output at the most important position than plenty of teams with question marks there. That's why I cared so much when Alvin Kamara was drafted by New Orleans a couple of seasons ago. We had a large enough sample to say that not only did New Orleans deploy their running backs in really favorable ways, but they have Drew Brees. The chance that the offense would nosedive in a three-year window was slim. And I feel the same way about Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs. Of course, I could be wrong, but I feel absolutely fine with giving a big boost to Mecole Hardman given the offense that he's walking into. And honestly, the same could be said for Paris Campbell and the Colts. So to answer your question more directly, when we're not talking about the extremes, it's a lot harder to predict and care about landing spot, because things can go in a lot of different directions. But if you know a team is lost, or you know it'll take at least a couple of years to get a quarterback, then it's fine to bump a guy down a little bit. And then the opposite, like I just talked through, is true too. This next question is from @FantasyStack. Curious to hear your thoughts on Amari Cooper, specifically his previous disappearing acts and resurgence. Do you see a specific source to previous poor performances, and is this now behind him? I ask because I find myself buying lately, but maybe have reason to be less bullish. Now, Amari Cooper was objectively better in Dallas than he was in Oakland. Quarterback play could be part of the reason. Scheme could be part of the reason. Straight up motivation could be part of the reason. I'm not sure we're ever going to get one single direct answer for why Amari Cooper was better in Dallas last year than in Oakland. But you could easily argue that his situation in general is just flat out better. But the main reason I wanted to bring this question up on today's podcast is that Amari Cooper was still pretty inconsistent last year with Dallas. Like, he still had these disappearing acts. He totaled 83 receiving yards during his final three games of the regular season. He had 76 or fewer yards receiving in all but two regular season games with Dallas last year. Now, there's nothing wrong with 76 yards. That's also me just giving you an arbitrary yardage total to say that Cooper had two big blow-up games that really catapulted himself into being a top fantasy football wideout. But from this, you could say that he's still not totally consistent. Now, wide receivers aren't consistent in general, but I'm basically saying that Cooper didn't show to be some elite player at the position for fantasy purposes last year. I'm still a little bit worried about Amari Cooper because Dallas will continue to be run-heavy, and Cooper himself was pretty heavy in the touchdown column last year. With Dallas, at least. My projections currently have him at wide receiver 16 for the 2019 season, and that's lower than his ADP. So I might not have a ton of Amari Cooper this year. A mid-wide receiver 2 price tag is obviously fine. That projection is saying that Amari Cooper is good, but I would not be taking Amari Cooper this season ahead of someone like AJ Green or Keenan Allen, all because of the reasons that I just stated. This next question is an email. It says, "Hey JJ, I just finished building my regression model showing expected touchdowns based on scrimmage yards. Zeke really stands out. I'm showing that he should have had 14 total touchdowns and he only had 9. The other top tier running backs all scored at an equal or a higher than expected rate. So Saquon, Kamara, McCaffrey, Gurley, and Gordon. Can I get some love for Zeke at number 1 overall? Nick." This is the beauty of building out projections because they automatically adjust for touchdown regression. While a lot of fantasy managers, and especially casual fantasy managers, will look at previous year numbers and use them to project in the current season, projections aren't being skewed by those wacky touchdown totals. And Zeke is one of those players for sure. To me, there's just a clear grouping of four running backs at the top of drafts with Saquon Barkley, Zeke, Christian McCaffrey, and Alvin Kamara. You can honestly make an argument for any of those guys first overall. I still have Barkley there because of what he could potentially do through the air this year. I think his PPR floor is absolutely insane. But I have no problem at all if you want to put Zeke in the 101 spot. He's as safe as they come, and like you said, others may not realize how few touchdowns he actually had last year versus how many he should have had. This next question is from @the47podcast. I want to hear your thoughts on Nick Chubb and why he isn't a top 10 running back lock. I don't think he's a lock at all to be a top 10 running back. Even when he took over that starting gig last year, he was the RB8 through the end of the year in PPR formats. From a points per game standpoint, he was 16th. You can remove players who didn't play a ton of games like Kerryon Johnson and Kareem Hunt, but he basically was either barely top 10 last year or he was not a top 10 back at all. And the reason for him to not be ranked as one this year is receiving volume. Last season, he had a target share in the 8% range when he was the starter. And that's fine for a running back. That's actually pretty decent. But the team now added Odell Beckham to the mix. They might throw the ball more and they'll be more efficient offensively, but OBJ is someone who's a big red zone threat, and he's obviously someone who's going to take a large target share in that offense. That naturally lowers everyone's target share in some way. There's only so much of the pie that players can get. And it's not like OBJ's target share is going to go down because there are other good players in that offense. It's Odell freaking Beckham. And then you have the wild card of what happens when Kareem Hunt returns. I don't think his return is going to be that significant, but he should take some work from Nick Chubb. And to me, the fear with Kareem Hunt is that he's going to take pass catching work. So the argument against Chubb to be outside the top 10 is a pretty easy one to make, in my opinion. Now, don't get me wrong, he can absolutely finish there. But there's a pretty good group of running backs in general at the top of this year's drafts, and that forces more competition, and that drives down Nick Chubb's ranking and cost. This next question says, "Hi JJ, what are your thoughts on the future outlook of Josh Rosen? Warren Sharp had Arizona ranked as facing the league's hardest passing defense last year, and Rosen was a rookie with a dysfunctional coach. Is there any precedence for a quarterback being drafted in the top 10 and being traded a year later and how they performed? Can you envision him having a rebound like Jared Goff did? Thanks, Jeremy." I learned my lesson in not judging quarterback play too quickly in the NFL with Jared Goff. For those of you who have listened to this podcast from the start, you know that. I thought Jared Goff was going to be toast after his rookie season because that's generally what we see. We generally see bad quarterbacks stay bad and good quarterbacks stay good. Rookie seasons actually tell us something. But a lot changed for Jared Goff, and that helped him. And he got better. I was wrong about Jared Goff. Though I do think that people still kind of view Jared Goff incorrectly right now. I have the same worries for Josh Rosen that I did for Jared Goff. But I do think that it's nice that we have a recent example of a Goff-like turnaround being possible. But here's the thing. If you look at all rookie quarterbacks since 1990 who threw 200 or more pass attempts, and if you look at their adjusted net yards per attempt rate during that season, the bottom of the list is horrific. The bottom basically like 30 has two hits in Donovan McNabb and Matthew Stafford, and three if you want to count Jared Goff. And if you want to count Josh Allen for whatever reason, that's four. But I don't think that we should be doing that right now. But Josh Rosen is part of that list. He had the ninth worst adjusted net yards per attempt among those relevant rookie quarterbacks since 1990. That's not something to just feel optimistic about. And for the record, the top of that list is Dak Prescott, Mark Bolger, RG3, Deshaun Watson, Russell Wilson, Matt Ryan, Ben Roethlisberger, Baker Mayfield. The list has a ton of hits. So it's hard to sell Rosen as someone who's likely to succeed or has a decent chance to succeed. But I certainly learned my lesson with Jared Goff to not simply count him out. He's just not something that I'm looking to trade for, given we know that there's at least some correlation between how a player performs during his rookie season as a quarterback to the rest of his career. This next question is from @PDXTroyBoy. Can you discuss the prospects of the two New England running backs, Sony Michel and Damian Harris? I'm hearing a lot of trade Sony after the draft. Will Belichick split carries and use a committee approach, or is Sony still his one and only? I think Michel's still going to get a lot of work on the ground, especially in the short term. But where I think people need to be worried about Sony Michel just in general is through the air. It's really hard to look at a projection for Sony Michel and feel comfortable about the number of targets that he's going to see, at least in 2019. Like, if you're hoping that he's going to be an RB1 in PPR formats, I don't think that's a reasonable expectation, because he might not even get like 30 targets. But Michel has a ton of touchdown potential in that offense. I actually think that he has a chance to lead the league in rushing touchdowns. So if you can get Michel at a discount thanks to Damian Harris, I'm not totally against that. But the main problem is that I think the community was already overrating Michel a bit because of what his passing game role is likely to look like. That's what happens when James White is on your team. This next question is an email from Hunter. He says, maybe I've missed something, but what the heck is the deal with this Ronald Jones hype? He's ranked 15 spots ahead of Peyton Barber on Fantasy Pros, yet had very limited work last season. Now, I won't write him off for the lack of production, but come on, you've seen it. It's not very appealing. I don't understand where this ideology has emerged from. Can you help me out? Yeah, I mean, I think the bottom line is that Peyton Barber isn't special in any way. The Bucs have a new coaching staff, and a lot of people liked Ronald Jones a lot coming out last season. But realistically, there aren't many running backs picked outside of round one but before pick 100 who panned out significantly since 2000 who also saw fewer than 50 carries during their rookie year. I know that's a mouthful, but Ronald Jones is part of that group. And there are some who did pan out. There are some round two and three running backs who didn't see a significant workload during their rookie season who did well. Kenyon Drake is someone who ended up becoming something for fantasy purposes. You've got Shane Vereen, Brian Westbrook back in the day. It's certainly happened before. But Jones really isn't the type of back that I like to target because his pass catching isn't there. It wasn't in college, and it was a key reason he couldn't find the field last year. And meanwhile, those guys that I just named were or are awesome pass catchers. So that's one of the reasons I'm not necessarily really bullish on Ronald Jones. But I can understand why people would rather go for the upside in Jones than what we already know from Peyton Barber. This next question is from @DPFootball1. Do you think Darius Geis will be an RB1 this year? I don't, no. I definitely don't. There's just too much in his way. The offense isn't likely to be very good. He's got Chris Thompson to deal with from a pass-catching standpoint. Adrian Peterson is still there. He's coming off an injury. I actually think that there's a good chance that Geis is really overdrafted this summer, and I won't have a lot of him. And honestly, a really quick rule of thumb is to just avoid players who don't have a pass-catching ceiling, who look to be in bad or hard-to-project offenses. So I would be pretty surprised if Darius Geis is a top 10 back this year. This last question is from @MrDayCarry. When drafting, what factors do you take into account for later round picks? For example, if there's a wide receiver that you covet, but his ADP is still a few rounds away, do you take him early or risk missing out? Love the show. Thanks. Yeah, so this is really just a giant opportunity cost equation. When you reach in the early rounds, the cost in doing so is larger. You're foregoing the opportunity to have better players. when you get to the middle rounds, that opportunity cost gets increasingly smaller. So it's a lot easier to reach for players because what you're giving up with reaching those players isn't very significant. It's like any purchase that you make. When you go and buy a house, it's a bigger investment, so you're thinking about what you could be spending that money on, or all the other houses that you could buy instead. There's a lot of anxiety. When you go buy a coffee at Starbucks, you're not thinking about all the other coffees that you could get instead. You don't care, because what you're foregoing isn't nearly as valuable. You're buying something cheap, and you're giving up something cheap. The late rounds of your fantasy drafts are like buying coffee, whereas the early rounds are like buying a house. You should care about the opportunity cost a lot more with the latter. That's going to do it for today's show. Thanks to everyone for listening. If you've yet to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast, make sure you are by searching for it on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Spotify. And if you're on iTunes, please do me a favor and leave a rating and review. And you can follow me on Twitter, @LateRoundQB. Thanks, everyone. Hope you have a great weekend and enjoy the Game of Thrones series finale.